episode 5 of the comic book Time Machine, Days of Future Past. Hey, and welcome back to the Comic Book Time Machine. I'm here with my buddies. We just stepped out of the Comic Book Time Machine, and we were back in 1980. And we picked up a couple comics that we want to talk about. So, my name is Ben Avery, and I'm a comic book fan and a comic book writer, and I've been joined by Matt Anderson.
Hello.
And Daniel Butcher.
Howdy-ho, neighbors.
And we are together again. We had some solo episodes, and we're going to have some more solo episodes after this, just the way we do things. But this is kind of our main series is the group conversations. And so we're back again for another group conversation. This time, what are we talking about, Matt?
Yeah, we're going to talk about Days of Future Past. So the movie just came out here in the year 2014. So we thought, let's look at where this all originated. So that's why we went back to 1980 to grab those issues.
Right. And now we're here, present day.
Now we're here recording in 2014.
Right.
So that we can discuss the comic and its place in history and how it kind of ties in, if at all, with the movie. And here's a warning for everybody out there. We are about to spoil Days of Future Past, the full storyline from 1980.
But not the storyline from 2014.
No, not at all.
We're not going to spoil the movie, but the comic we're going to spoil. Because it's really old, and it's easy to read. It's easy to find in collections and online and stuff. So,
yeah, so if you haven't read it yet, we recommend it. But don't listen to this episode unless you're open to being spoiled.
There we go. Spoiler warning. Daniel, when was the first time you heard about Days of Future Past?
Oh, I heard about it years ago. Just not in 1980.
Yeah.
I want to say I've probably known about it for at least 10 years. Actually, no, I knew about it back in my prime comic book days in the mid-80s. I just never read it. It's only in the last 3-4 years that I had a chance to get my hands on a copy for the first time in a collected trade. So this time it's kind of interesting since I'm not reading a modern collection. I'm just reading the two issues that it actually is.
Yeah, I had heard about it in my comic collecting heyday, junior high and high school, when I would get catalogs from like Mile High Comics and those kind of things. And I just, you know, send a dollar away and then get this newsprint thick catalog. And it would have pictures of, you know, classic things and the new hot stuff. So Wolverine number one, you know, that was had some sort of featured image because it just looked so cool. And I was like, oh, I got to read this. I never did. But this is another one that because of just the classic status that it had even back in the late 80s, it was one that I had heard about and knew about. I had no idea what happened, but looking at the covers, I was just like, oh, that looks really interesting. But I didn't care about these X-Men. Like, this group of X-Men, I didn't know about many of them, and I wasn't reading X-Men. I was reading, if I was buying stuff, it was Spider-Man or Captain America or Avengers.
But you see, for me, this was my X-Men. I just had the more mature X-Men. So for me, Kitty Pryde was a functional adult. She wasn't let's be honest, a teenager.
Yeah. Well, and for me,
she was a fully trained X-Men. Yeah. Actually, in my prime, she was a member of Excalibur.
That's where I knew her from. That's where I know. I mean, that's for me. That's the character that I think of when I think of Kitty Pryde, is Shadowcat.
Yeah. So is it Pixie they keep calling her in this?
Yeah.
No, Sprite.
They call Sprite. That's Sprite. It really throws me off because I'm like, no, her name's Shadowcat.
Yeah. So, and I honestly never read it until right before the movie came out. And I was like, I got to read this before the movie comes out. So I finally did. So Matt, how have you known about this storyline or what's your history with the storyline?
Yeah, I know exactly when I first heard about Days of Future Past, and that was in 1993. And it's all because of the X-Men, the animated series. And so, really, that cartoon was my first real exposure to the X-Men universe. And so, I mean, we'll find out as we talk through the synopsis of this storyline that this is not true. But I always, you know, when I think of Days of Future Past, honestly, I still think of Bishop traveling back from the future to stop something from happening, and he finds the X-Men, and they're like legends to him. And so that's what I really think of it, you know, as we'll find when we dive into this. Bishop doesn't even appear in these two issues, so it's kind of interesting. So,
well, yeah, Bishop wasn't even a gleam in his creator's eye yet.
Exactly. And so, again, when we look at this team, that the different mutants that make up the X-Men in this storyline, a lot of these aren't people I was as familiar with, because the X-Men, the animated series team, is who I think of. So Kitty Pryde, I probably never read a story that she was in until Joss Whedon's Astonishing X-Men. I mean, you know, when they were first putting together the animated series, they had thought about using Kitty Pryde, but instead they went with Jubilee as the main character. So I kind of wish that I had Kitty Pryde in my childhood, because she's a much more interesting character. But yeah, so that's my first exposure, 1993, the animated series. Oh, and I should say, right after that, then I bought a trade. I mean, these days, this would be really interesting. It's a trade that just collects the two issues. So I'm looking at the back. It was $5.95 back in the mid-90s. And so I have it collected here.
Oh, wow.
Two issues. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, if we hadn't used the time machine to go back in time and buy these off the exactly. spinner rack for 50 cents, I would have used Marvel Ultimate to read this.
Exactly.
I mean, Unlimited.
Yeah, Unlimited. Marvel Unlimited. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank goodness for the time machine. Otherwise, I would have had to use this bound copy I have on my shelf.
Right, you would have had to, you know, just reached over and pulled it off the shelf instead of the obviously easier route.
But you know what I find interesting, though, when we talk about that, is I wish that I had had the trade that had just the two. Because when I read it in a trade that had multiple. It was 184 pages long, so it had much more than just these two issues. And when I went and rated it, I only gave that a 3 out of 5.
Mm-hmm. I think on Goodreads.
But I think that if I had had just these two issues, I probably would have given it a 5 out of 5. Mm-hmm. So I think the other issues that were with it in that collection really kind of held down the story. Because, I mean, please don't be offended when I say this, Ben. Do I really need the first appearance of Alpha Flight when I'm reading Days of Future Past?
Yeah, you do, because that's like, isn't that just a few issues before?
But do I really need it?
Well, why wouldn't you?
Well, here's the thing also that...
By the way, I'm not a big fan of Alpha Flight. I've hardly read any Alpha Flight.
Daniel, I'm guessing something that hampered the whole experience also is that comics from this time were much wordier, and I think they did a good job at making sure that every issue... like could be somebody's first issue. So even in the second part of Days of Future Past here, we had lots of explanation to catch everybody up. And so I can imagine if you're reading a trade that has tons of these issues altogether, you feel like you're getting the same information over and over again.
Yeah. If you ever read like the Marvel Essential Hulk, that's like from his first issue on, it is bad to just sit down and read. It's okay, probably, if you're going to like space it out over a year, but you're basically getting the same plot line in every mm-hmm. story. It's, and it's the same kind of thing here, where you are going to get the same, well, I've got my claws, and I'm going to extend them now, and or in the next one, it might be Wolverine extends his claws with a thought or whatever, but it's just like this constant repetition of introducing the character, which is good, yeah, if it's your first issue. Mm-hmm. I wish there was a little bit more of that, actually, in today's comics. Where it's...
Well, and speaking of today's comics, could either one of you imagine an entire story arc, especially of this magnitude, being captured in just two issues?
I know. It's amazing.
It's not six, because I've read some Wolverine comics. The last volume of Wolverine, the one where at the beginning he loses his healing ability. The one from over, you know, like 2013. The first storyline in that is six issues. To be honest, it should have just been two.
Yeah.
And I felt like since it was pushed out to six issues, and the only reason it was pushed out to six issues is because they were going to make their money on the trade, it was kind of boring. Because there was just too much unneeded stuff that just needed to be cut out.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate reality of modern comics, is they're writing to the trade, and also this was a decompressed storytelling, where there's hardly any words. Mm-hmm. A lot of time is spent with just large panels. And, you know, that's, they also call it cinematic, I think, sometimes, too. But it's, it makes for some beautiful artwork sometimes. But it is, I think, a poor way to pace storytelling.
Well, when you talk about, you know, the pacing of the storytelling, when we get to issue 142 of this, when I do the summary, the summary of issue 142 is there's a fight. But it's not done the same way that it would be now, where you would have just panels with no words, like pages and pages of panels with no words, as this fight's going on. It's a very different fight. There's a lot more going on because it's not just something that you're cruising through in like 2-3 minutes to go through 10 pages. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I have found remarkable is a modern comics reader versus when I was as a child is, I swear these things used to take me half an hour to read.
They did.
I can take a comic today and give it a good run through and understand it, and not really be skipping over anything, and I can have it done in 12 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because in the old days, I feel like we were getting our money's worth when it came to the comics. Nowadays, and I'm not saying this is the case all the time, but in a lot of cases, I mean, is it worth $3 that you're putting down? I actually like individual comics, but an argument could be made that it might be better just to save the money for the trade, but if that was the case, then the business would go downhill and we'd be in trouble, but yeah, it would.
Well, but I mean, like, so when Original Sin was out there, I was reading that every 2 weeks as an individual comic, and the way it was moving the action forward, it was the sort of thing where I wouldn't have wanted to wait for the trade because I needed to stay with that storyline, because I was finding out things that I was like whispering to Ben about, hey, Ben, you need to know about this. Because, yeah, I know eventually he's going to see it, but it's going to take him 6 to 9 months for him to either see it in a collection or see it in Marvel Unlimited. I needed to know. A lot of comics, though, I mean, again, going back to that Wolverine one, the action, the cliffhangers was just not enough for me to say, I really want to read the next one.
Yeah, well, that's where, with the writing for the trade, there's trouble. I mean, this goes back to, you know, they used to do the 4-issue limited miniseries type of things. And, oh my goodness, you got so much story. And it was intended to be beginning, middle, and end. But you got so much out of it. But each one would end on a cliffhanger. However, you're getting, like, a huge episode. And it's harder when you're stretching out the story that much longer to have a cliffhanger. And, you know, when I'm writing my own things, like when I was working on Hedge Knight, that was a story that was already written for me that I had to then adapt. I had to find those cliffhangers so it could be a 6-issue miniseries. But when I did this third one, they said, we're not even doing individual issues. We're just doing one graphic novel. It was so nice, so freeing. And you could pace it based on what the story needed instead of pacing it based on what the format needs. And you're going to find that here too, but you're just getting more story.
Well, and so what I agree with you, those 4-issue miniseries, and I know we're totally getting off base now. I recently got my hands on a collected edition of John Ostrander's Deadshot limited series back from the 80s. And it is so good. And it's just like you're describing, 4 issues, dense, so much going on that you're moving forward quickly. You never feel like you're, you know, just getting fluff to expand it, because again, there's a lot of story to tell and just 4 issues to put it in. And then it's a really good trade in the 2000s, because along with that really good story, they're able to put in like a key appearances of Deadshot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, I like, but that's me more. I like sitting down and reading a story more than I like getting a chapter every month. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, sitting down and reading this on Marvel Unlimited, I loved it because I didn't have to wait a month to find out, you know, what happens next. But it's just, the other thing is these 2 issues, they form a nice, tight little, you know, complete story. It's I mean, there's some of the soap opera storylines coming from, you know, these other threads elsewhere. Like you have in this Kitty Pryde, she's new. She's new to the X-Men, and so that's one thread that's kind of getting played into there. But you get everything you need to know right up front. And so the other thing is, because of that, I didn't feel like I needed to keep on going. You know, even though it ended, you know, with oh, this, what's going to happen next? You know, what in the lives of the X-Men? But I was like, ah, I got these two issues. I read them. I'm good. I'm not.
So I think we're going to have Daniel do the synopsis, but I'm just going to give a few quick bullet points of interesting information. Are you ready for the synopsis, Daniel?
Yeah, whenever you're...
All right, here we go. Quick information. So we know that the regular Marvel mainline universe is Earth 616. Are you guys aware of the Earth number for the Days of Future Past universe?
Nope.
Anybody?
Nope, right. Nope.
Earth 811. So if you ever want to check out more of this disaster, you can go to Earth 811. We had already mentioned that both of these comics came out in 1980. So the Uncanny X-Men issue number 141, the cover date was January 1981, but originally released on October 14th, 1980, and the follow-up issue 142, cover date February 1981, but released November 18th, 1980. In 2001, this comic storyline was voted, let's see, it was named number 25 on the list of Marvel's greatest comics of all time.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
You want to talk about that right now?
Well, I think we'll talk about it when we get out of the story. But, yeah.
So you kind of want to talk about, is it worthy of that number?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
One last thing. First appearance in this storyline of Rachel Summers, who becomes a pretty big X-Men character, and you guys mentioned Excalibur.
Mm-hmm.
She's a big character there. She's not actually referred to by her full name, though, as Rachel Summers. She's just referred to as Rachel, and the writers later retconned her into the character that we now know as Marvel Girl, Rachel Summers. She also went by Phoenix. Any other names she had?
I don't know. I didn't realize they retconned, though. I thought that they, from what I knew, I thought that they had intended that, but I guess I was wrong.
No. I don't want to... I could be definitely wrong about that. I just kind of assumed that, actually, after reading it, because they left out her name, that it was probably a change later. Oh, and Franklin Richards from the Fantastic Four, he's a young son in the current storyline, but he's an adult in the Days of Future Past Earth, and he is in a relationship with Rachel Summers, so that's interesting. And yeah. Weird that now she exists in the same world as her, a young version of her boyfriend. Kind of
you know, it really is not that weird. It happens more than you'd expect. You just roll with it, you know?
What I find interesting, again, Ben and I both mentioned that we really knew Kitty Pryde from Excalibur, and Rachel Summers was also one of those original members of Excalibur.
Mm-hmm. And so that's where I knew her from. So I just assumed when I saw Rachel and saw her costuming, I was, oh, I didn't realize this is where she came from. So it was cool.
All right, Daniel, take it away.
It's New York City in a scary future, the year 2013.
About
time. We open up. We've got New York City. It's pretty trashed. It doesn't look like a normal day. As Kate Pryde walks up Park Avenue carrying a box for the Sentinels. As she's walking through, she goes into rogue territory. No, not that rogue, but a gang that attempts to assault her. And they run into a man with claws, though he doesn't use them. Yes, it's Colonel Logan from the Canadian Resistance. That's right, Colonel Logan from the Canadian Resistance. You gotta love this. With very, very white hair on the sides. He gives Kate the last component of the jammer and sends her off on her merry way.
Not Star Jammer.
No, just the jammer.
Just the jammer.
Some sort of machine.
As she returns home, we discover that it is, in 2013, there are three classes of people. There are humans, which are people who are allowed to breed because they're clean of mutant genes. There are anomalous humans, which are people who possess the potential for a mutant birth and are not allowed to breed. And there are mutants who are not allowed to breed and are the bottom of the social class, and that all of American society is ruled over by robots called the Sentinels.
Now, is this the first appearance of the Sentinels in
No, X-Men not at comics? All.
Okay, I didn't think it was.
They've been around, actually, since that first team. The Jean Grey, Marvel Girl, Cyclops, Iceman, Angel, Beast team, they fought the Sentinels.
Okay.
And so this is just kind of a progression, you know, 100 issues later. But it's a progression of this is what our Sentinel program could turn into.
It's kind of interesting because no matter which version of this storyline exists in, you know, whatever form of media, the Sentinels are always the huge main part of it. So I wonder how they became like the face of the Days of Future Past world.
Well, I think because of this issue, I mean, just the classicness of the story, I think is what does it.
And I think they're fun to play with because in all the different other versions of this, where you go into the future and you see the Sentinels, you're able to play with them, you're able to evolve them, you're able to make those different versions because they're robots, and robots are something you can change pretty easily.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's a question I think I have for both of you. Is there a Dalek factor here? The machine that is emotionless. You can't barter with it. You can't negotiate mm-hmm. with it. So in many ways, for a human, it's the ultimate enemy because it's never going to show empathy to you.
Yeah.
That's a good comparison because the Daleks and the Sentinels are both not supposed to have emotion, but they both display emotion. Like, the Sentinels do display some emotion in these two issues. Like, when they're getting destroyed and they're like, ah.
Is that emotion or is that just bad writing?
See, or perhaps it's just programming.
Yeah, they're programmed to pretend to have emotion, which, I mean, maybe in humanity, that's what it is. We're just programmed to react. It's not real emotion.
So as Kate returns to the mutant ghetto, we get a classic shot here in which she walks past the graves of those who have already died. And she talks about how they were her family. So we see these tombstones, and amongst the tombstones that we can read are Kurt Wagner, Warren Worthington, Scott Summers, and Charles Xavier, all from the X-Men. But then, of also interest, you can plainly read Susan Richards, Ben Grimm, and Johnny Storm. You maybe Reed Richards. Yes, you can. You can see Reed Richards, too. Which, I think they probably do it better in the movie, where they mentioned in the movie that the Sentinels killed mutants and those sympathetic to mutants.
Yeah. Well, but and here, in this, they're killing off any superheroes because children of superheroes tend to have superpowers. So Franklin Richards is a mutant because Reed Richards and Sue were altered humans. And so their children have mutant powers. And so this is something they're getting rid of, the potential for mutants.
And Reed does have the mutant M on his coveralls when we do meet him in the future.
Hey, by the way, Daniel, Matt, you know, this is the year 2013. We're in the year 2014 right now. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say I really enjoyed going to New York and riding in those horse-drawn buses when I went to New York a couple years ago.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed riding on those, and it's not as bad as it looks here in the comics. But
were they comfortable? Were they?
Well, yeah, they're bus seats, but a nice leisurely pace because it's horses that are pulling them. But it's one panel, and it's a nice just glimpse at we are in post-apocalypse right now.
Yeah, it's done really well.
I mean, it's a real subtle thing, unlike the Rogues, not subtle at all, with their mohawks and their faux talk. But, yeah. Anyway, continue.
Well, and I do want to call out, again, this graveyard scene, which is classic, because I'd also like to call it All Those Who Can't Appear in the MCU.
Oh, that's interesting.
That is interesting.
So Kate returns home.
Oh, wait. You missed one. Between Kurt Wagner and Hank McCoy, over on the right, is Peter Parker.
Oh.
I mean, you just see a PE, and you see, for the first name, you see PE. For the second name, you can see AR. It's but, yeah, Peter Parker.
I can also see Bobby Drake and Lorna Dane.
Yep. But again, you're just getting like two letters on some of those.
Yeah.
So Kate returns home to meet up with her family, which includes, at this time, Storm.
Mm-hmm.
Reed Richards.
No.
Not Reed Richards.
Franklin Richards. Come on. Rachel. Reed Richards. Franklin Richards' wife. Peter Rasputin, or Colossus.
Technically, Rachel is just referred to as his lady.
Oh, his lady. Or is it even that, or is it his woman?
It does. It says, and his lady, Rachel. Okay. A telepath telekinetic.
And don't forget, the dude rolling up in a wheelchair.
Well, and when the dude rolls up in the wheelchair, we've already seen that Charles Xavier is dead. And for a moment, you're like, oh, it's not. No, it's Magneto.
For a moment, you're not like that. You know why? Because it's all on the same page. This is one of those things where that should have been at the bottom of the page, so you have a turn, and then you're like, oh, it's not him. But there's so much story crammed in here. There's no room for, like, these real, you know, these big reveals with the page turns and stuff like that.
Yeah, but technically on the panel, she does call out Magneto.
That's so true. That's true. Yeah, it's right there.
I mean, it's
hey, did you mention Colossus?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So they're all getting together.
You forgot one thing about Colossus. Nope. This guy is Kate's man.
Yeah. Her husband. She's changed her name.
He says to her, a moment, my wife. Yeah.
The dialogue in this is awesome.
I
mean, in an older style.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's get out of the plot here. Let's continue with the plot. Let's move along.
So they've got a plan. Mutants have an inhibitor collar on them, and the jammer is going to allow them to use their powers and no longer be stopped by the inhibitor collars. Rachel is going to concentrate and send Kate Pryde into the past, into her own past, by having her change minds with a younger version of herself, which brings us to Friday, October 31st, 1980.
Just a few
days after this was on the shelf. And we jump into the Danger Room, where the X-Men are currently working out and doing some training. Kitty Pryde comes into the room, and she is not prepared.
She's not supposed to be there.
And they freak out because they're still fighting, and they're still going against all the dangers of the Danger Room, and there's not enough emergency shutoff buttons in this place. And Nightcrawler jumps in, and hits the button. And then they all have a good, hearty laugh. Or not.
Okay.
But they do. Oh, go ahead.
I have so many problems with this. First of all, of all people to walk into a room like that and not be in danger, she's the one.
But she's freaking out. She's freaking out.
And I'm confused because I'm thinking she's freaking out because, oh, it's her from the future. It's not. She's not in there yet. We are just taking our own time machine back a little bit earlier than when future Kitty Pryde enters. But all she has to do is just use her phase power and step backwards out of the door. Or use her phase power and everything that's coming at her will not, you know, hit her or hurt her. But I understand she's new.
Guys, let's just be honest. Clearly, Charles Xavier needs to be put up on charges of child endangerment.
Yeah, that's clear.
Well, I don't understand why Colossus, who could... Okay, there's so much you can nitpick here.
Well, if he was to catch her in his metal form, he would break her. We don't want another Gwen Stacy situation here.
Okay, she's going to land in his solid arms, and then the pile driver thing is going to land on him. And so if he would just stay in his, you know, solid state, it'd be okay.
Well, why doesn't he just change once he has her?
Right.
He's trying to avoid Gwen Stacy's situation.
It just... Oh, but Nightcrawler, he thinks fast. Ah, the button. That stops
the panic button.
Oh, wait, we do have a button. We do.
And there's actually an interesting bit of information here. When he teleports in, they say, or the box of information says, a burst of flame coupled with the stench of brimstone heralds the arrival of Nightcrawler. So I don't think I realized that every time he teleported, it made a smell.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's something I did know about. That's cool.
Yeah, and they used to write that in all the time.
Well, they had to.
Yeah, well, again, yeah, because you needed to know.
So they're going to hammer it in that there's brimstone.
Mm-hmm. So just in case you guys, I don't know if you heard me say this before, but they did say she was too nervous to use her phasing powers. So
yeah, I understand.
At least there was a bit of explanation and not just nothing.
But don't worry, she's not so nervous that 13 seconds later they can't run her through the danger room programming that's set up just for her.
Which makes no sense. Why are they doing this to her?
Yeah, it's like, hey, you've just gone through this horrible experience where you freaked out. What we've done now is we've completely set up the danger room to kill you.
Yeah, there's so,
somebody call a social worker.
There's two lines of thought here. One is, how dare you come in here like that? For punishment, we're going to make you walk through here again. Or, okay, you shouldn't have done that, and so now it's your turn. You know, it just. But if you notice, the things coming at her, they're like pillows. So, like, they're launching pillows at her, and, like, the these two mechanical walls that come crunching in on her, like the trash compactor in Star Wars or something, it seems to have, like, cushions in there. So, I you know, they put on the kid gloves for her, but.
Well, she makes it through with flying colors. Nothing can beat her in the danger room, which leads to one of my favorite frames in the entire issue, which is Wolverine laughing and laughing with his friends.
All right, you ready? His dialogue. I thought I'd seen it all. Charlie spends weeks programming the room for Kitty, and she beats it with her eyes closed. What was Xavier expecting out of her?
I think he was trying to kill her. Call a social worker.
He knows her power set. Her power set is to walk through things.
But again, you have to love Wolverine. This is probably the happiest you're ever going to see Wolverine.
Oh, by far.
When he's not intoxicated.
I also want to make a note here that this is my favorite Wolverine costume, the brown and yellow one.
Yes, I agree with that.
I love the brown and yellow.
I cannot stand the blue and yellow.
Yeah.
I like the brown and orange for some reason. I don't know if it's... I don't know what it is.
So Kitty's made it through, flying colors. She's feeling good about herself. We have a good laugh, and suddenly she passes out.
Yeah. It's a real problem.
The medical bay where apparently Wolverine, who has limited education, is well-skilled in the use of all of the medical equipment within the lab. And Kate Pryde has now taken over Kitty's body and gives a nice big hug to her dead friend, Nightcrawler.
And we know something's going on. They know something's going on because he scares her.
Earlier.
Yeah.
Earlier.
She feels creeped out around him. She's not used to this blue-skinned guy with devil ears and a tail. Now he's getting a hug from her. And she's scaring him now.
This is also probably one of the first moments where we can notice that Storm is missing some fabric from her costume.
Yeah, Storm's costume makes no sense.
Okay.
You can't be comfortable.
I think we could safely say that women's costumes oftentimes don't make sense in comic books.
True.
I mean,
but this one is especially bad, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's especially bad.
I don't know. It makes sense. You got the little ring thing holding her pants up. It's like a really nice, classy version of suspenders that you would...
For a go-go dancer.
These are the classiest suspenders I've ever seen.
That's my favorite kind of suspenders, is the little ring thing on my belly.
All right, I just hope Matt's wife doesn't catch him watching, reading this.
It looks like you guys both have the page in front of you. So I've never noticed until just now how similar Nightcrawler's and Colossus's costumes are. Like with the shoulders.
You're right.
Out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The V style.
It's because you're so constantly, your eye is drawn to the metal skin.
Mm-hmm.
With the lines, which I don't understand. I never understood why he has like robotic joints, but we're not going to get into that right now. Let's continue.
I love Colossus. That's a great.
So Kate fills him in. They all wind up believing her, and she tells them the story about the fact that the Sentinels are someday in the future going to murder and start a mutant holocaust. And it all begins now when a mutant killed Senator Kelly.
Oh, you skipped another great part, though. Wolverine, why he believes her. She looks like a kid, but she stands, talks, moves, smells like a woman.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. Her smell shouldn't have changed.
No, not at all.
Matt's like, analyzing it over here. Yes, her walk could be different. Her movement, but not the smell.
Not the smell?
Chris Claremont, I call you out right now. The smell was too much.
You're taking this too far.
So, yeah, all this thing, you've got, who is that? Is that Kelly that's in that top right corner there?
No, that's the...
America, it's 1984. Do you know what your children are?
That's not Kelly. No, that's the guy that takes over after Kelly is assassinated.
Okay.
This is the new president that... I don't think they named him, but this is the guy that first proposes the Mutant Control Act.
But you have this panel that looks like Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
You see the Sentinels, and then you have another panel of all of these people that we know and love X'd out.
Okay, so this panel is very interesting because it's all heroes except for one...
Uh-huh.
A modern day villain, and so I think the implication is that he becomes a hero. So, Daniel, do you want to read off what we've got there?
Well, I can, but yeah, I'll come back to it. We got Daredevil, we got Scarlet Witch, we got Beast, we got Cyclops, we got somebody that I'm assuming is Angel, Nightcrawler, Professor X,
mm-hmm.
Spider-Man, Iron Man, Johnny Flame, Black Panther, Captain America, Hulk, Dr. Doom.
Dr. Doom? What?
Dr. Doom. Here's the thing about Dr. Doom, too, though, is this is all American stuff happening.
Mm-hmm.
Did the Sentinels go and assassinate him in Latveria? Or Latvia? I don't know how you say it.
I think the implications are that in the future, he joins one of these super teams and lives in America.
Well, it says in the caption, both heroes and villains.
Well, and as we know in the story, too, the rest of the world is watching.
Yeah.
Because if the Sentinels move out of the United States, they're going to, destroy the world.
And that's why they have to do this plan, this desperate plan to go back in time, because they're averting World War III.
Here's what I think you guys are missing. It's all about Senator Kelly. Well, in the movie, it's all about Stryker. But we can't, in the movie, kill Kelly because Kelly's already dead.
Yeah, they already did that plot line.
And again, I was reading later in these, and Kate Pryde keeps talking about how Kelly's a decent man. He's got legitimate concerns. When I was reading him later, I never got the sense that he was a good guy.
Yeah, me either.
So,
she was young.
Meanwhile, in 2013, as the X-Men fly to Washington, D.C., the Sentinels attack. And they carry Kate Pryde's body out, hiding it. And one mutant has to sacrifice himself, Magneto, to slow them down, but not for long. And then Franklin Richards dies.
Now, this, I don't know if you guys know this, but he couldn't die like this. In modern Fantastic Four, they've established Franklin, even as a child, as one of the most powerful entities in the universe. So this couldn't have happened. Do you guys know, a quick question for you, was Franklin already established as a mutant at this point in comics history?
Yeah, he was a child mutant. I mean, they knew about his power. Slowly it grew over time, but... Yeah.
So it's not good for our future team. Wolverine slashes. Things fall down. And then back in our day, 1980.
There's two panels of fighting here that would have been a whole issue.
Yeah.
Today.
I mean, this. Yeah.
Well, today, one of the issues would have stopped with Franklin Richards' death.
Yeah.
Or it would have left us there. And then when the next issue started, he would have died. So
we have the bad guys yappity yappity yapping.
Wait, I don't want to keep going back, but this is kind of interesting. Right when they're fighting the Sentinels in 2013, you see a poster on the wall that says new for 1985, and I think it's an Oldsmobile poster hanging on the wall here that the Sentinels walk by. So again, the implications are that 5 years after this assassination, that's when everything goes wrong. And the Sentinels have been in control since 1985 at minimum.
Yeah, I get the impression that it's kind of that's the buildup, and that's kind of the climax where they stop producing new stuff. They may not have complete control, but they're close to it.
Yep.
And it's kind of like, okay, it's wartime. Bad things are happening. Oldsmobiles are not being produced after 1985, which is probably the worst thing that possibly happened to our world. But
right. Yeah.
So let's get to the bad guys.
Now back to 1980, we go to the Pentagon when one staffer named Raven Darkholm walks through the halls of the Pentagon, and we find out she's actually a mutant. She's Mystique.
I find it really interesting. I didn't realize she was a big part of this comic book.
Yeah, she's a really big part of this book.
And she's a big part of the movie. And I was surprised to find that out.
She's the founder and leader of the new Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. And she's assembled a team. Now, here in this introduction, they're all new except for one. When I bumped into these guys later, they were all Freedom Force.
Yeah, they were all good guys.
Well, they were good bad guys. But I never got the sense of, oh, this is a brand new spanking team, because I wasn't reading this in 1980. I was reading it, you know, 5-6 years later. But we get Blob is the only member of the old Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. We got Pyro, Avalanche, and Destiny. And they are making some plans and drinking some beers and making fun of each other.
They're not getting along very well.
No. They're not exactly team players.
No.
And so there's a lot of yelling and who's going to be in charge. And Mystique is trying to establish that she is the leader. She's not Magneto, but she is the leader. Meanwhile, in the United States Senate, the mutant hearings are occurring as seen on CNN. Actually, there was no CNN in 1980 on every TV, was there?
Couldn't tell you.
Yeah. No C-SPAN. I know there was no C-SPAN. So the mutant hearings are in place. Maria McTaggart is there, along with Charles Xavier. There's some talking and some talking, and then the X-Men come in, and then there's an explosion, and the Brotherhood attacks. But who's there to fight them but the X-Men?
Of course.
If you mean to harm Senator Kelly Mystique or anyone here, you'll have to go through us to get to him. And, of course, Mystique says, that will be a pleasure.
And that's where we have our big cliffhanger, which is not a bad cliffhanger.
No, it's good.
I mean, this is everything's come to a head for our timelines here. This is where it could all change or all stay the same. And so in issue number 142, it says, this issue, everybody dies. So I get the impression that it all stays the same and we just are going to get stuck with that history, right?
Well, but who's everybody?
That's a really good question.
And the thing is I think, you know, maybe in 1980, we may not have been as cynical about that. But, I mean, today, you know, we're all getting ready for this fall with the Wolverine dies storyline. And anyone here actually believe Wolverine's going to be dead longer than it takes to get another X-Men movie out?
Yeah. I think partly this is the issue, though, that gives us that, classic, you know, 25th best Marvel storyline ever, is because you do get to see the future versions of these characters die. On the cover, Wolverine and Storm are both...
Storm.
Was she still alive? I don't remember her being there. Well, anyway. Wolverine, you know, you see him getting blasted. You see Storm is hanging lifeless. And so you're looking at that cover and... Okay, everyone dies.
Everybody the cover does dies. Spoil exactly how she'll die. She's got a stake in her back, which is how they kill her in the comic.
Well, I mean, it's even spoiling Wolverine because he gets that big blast. So
yeah,
that's a classic panel. The one where he actually dies is, I've seen that panel many places before reading this issue.
You know, we're about to dive into issue 142, but issue 141, the one we just looked at, that cover is classic too. We didn't talk about that at all with all the posters.
Yeah. That gets used as a lot of parodies and posters and all that kind of thing. Yeah, advertisements. It's been on other covers. where they'll put different people in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a, yeah, it is a good cover. Better than this one. 142's cover, the Sentinel just looks kind of dorky. Wolverine's dying, and he's dying at the hands of, like, the nerdiest, dorkiest looking Sentinel I've ever seen.
I actually don't think the Sentinel design is that cool in general. I think the ones that we got, I think the actual classic looking ones in the 60s, or was it the 70s?
It was the 70s. You mean the movie?
The movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are pretty cool, but these ones in both the cartoon and in the comics, not that good. All right, Daniel, take it away.
So, we open up, and the fight begins.
No.
Giant splash page.
Oh. We open up, and we get told everything that happened. Here's all the stuff. Words, telling you what happened last issue. Then, the fight begins.
And so... you guys aren't going to like me as I summarize now, because as Ben knows from Welcome to Level 7, there's certain parts of the show that I call talkie, 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 talkie. So here, just let me do it. Fighty, 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 fighty.
So but the difference is it's fighty, fighty, fighty with lots of talkie, talkie, talkie.
Oh, there's tons of talkie, talkie, talkie.
There's so much talking, and this is where... it's comic book timeline. How can Wolverine in this panel say, you know, a minute's worth of dialogue in 1 2-second jump? It's just so much talking. So much talking. And then more talking. And more talking. But you're getting some cool fight scenes while they're talking.
And again, you know, I feel like back, you know, in 1980, they're trying to get the most out of every panel that they can.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about the time that it took to, when you go back and you read Marvel history, there's a lot of missed deadlines. And you can get the sense of why. Because again, you know, you read Wolverine today and there's pages that may not have any text on it. These pages, every square millimeter feels like it's being used one way or another.
Yeah, this page after the double page splash, you've got Wolverine doing his thing. You've got Nightcrawler doing his thing. You've got Colossus doing his thing.
Doing and Storm.
All of these characters are doing their powers, and they're also explaining them. So,
yeah.
Nightcrawler, I can punch and disappear far faster than you can react. And explaining what he's doing to the guy he's punching. I don't know why. I wouldn't do that. I'd just be, like, punching him. But, and then you have Colossus. He turns to metal, and... Pyro's saying, so, Colossus, you've the power to transform yourself into some form of metal. Again, thank you very much, you know, for the exposition.
But, hey, again, as a writer, it would have made your life easier. You know, you have to say brimstone every episode, you know, issue. You know, you're going to have to mention,
that's true.
You know, you turn into metal even though I see you turn into metal.
Yeah, this is the difficulty of I think, trying to show and not tell. But then also bring everyone up to speed.
Here on the next page, we see Angel flying, and it says, hi, kitty, I fly because I have wings. No, it doesn't say that, but you get the sense it could.
Yeah, the Angel, he's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah. So all this fighty, fighty, fighty really doesn't matter, because in the end, what happens is Mystique does kidnap Professor Xavier. Destiny and Mystique have a conversation. And Destiny's not able to figure out what's going to happen in the future. She can no longer predict. There's some sort of anomaly that's keeping her from fully using her vision.
And this is kind of a cool little element. We didn't talk much about Destiny, but she can... When Nightcrawler is punching Avalanche and explaining to him how I'm punching you, and now I'm punching you again so fast you can't even... It's not fast enough for, you know... I'm talking while I'm doing this. So it's not that fast because I'm saying so many words, but she says to Avalanche, punch left, you know, and he does, and he's able to punch and, you know, strike Nightcrawler where he's going to appear next. But I like Destiny. It's a cool little power she has where you can kind of see into the future, but now we've got, like you said, this anomaly. This is a cool element.
And her power is made more cool when you think about the fact that she is blind. So she's blind, but can see the future.
Right. So she's able to walk around and not trip over things.
Did you guys know that issue 141 that we just talked about was actually Destiny's first appearance?
Yes. Because Daniel told us.
Because she's a new member.
Yeah.
Newest member.
So we know that Anomaly is, in fact, Kate Pride.
Right.
Who then begins to remind us all, as readers, does she remind us? Or does Louise Jones, who, fun fact, has probably seen Walter Simonson naked, she reminds us all of the action that occurred in the last issue.
Well, because they're married, you mean?
Yes. That's why they're married, because she becomes Louise Simonson. So.
But it's Kitty Pryde thinking about it. And so Kate Pryde's thoughts twist forward across the decades to her home. And then all the story, everything from last issue is in these five panels.
Man.
Well, everything from the future.
And a lot of words. There's a lot of words there.
There is.
So, of course, we jump to 2013. Our crew's under arrest. And there's some more fighting. They fight the Sentinels in the future. We're moving forward. We're going to attack the Sentinel. What is it even called? It's not a Sentinel High Command. That's in my mind what I keep calling it. But they're gonna.
It's the Baxter Building, though.
Well,
they're infiltrating the Baxter Building. This is, you know, this is cool. This is where I'm understanding. They get to see into the future. It's this alternate future. They get to see all these recognizable things. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, and a big part of the Marvel Universe. So we have Storm, Wolverine, and Colossus, who have snuck into the Baxter Building. Rachel is guarding the body of Kate Pryde with Kitty's body in it. And, of course, we jump to 1980, where the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants and the X-Men are continuing their fighting.
We do
get a piece of dialogue that's kind of a big deal, which is we find out that Storm is the leader and Cyclops is gone.
Right, which we'll talk about, you know, where this lands in X-Men history in a moment here. But,
so fighting. So when we talk about fighting, here's page 1 of fighting, page 2 of fighting, page 3 of fighting, page 4 of fighting, page 5 of fighting, page 6 of fighting, page 7 of fighting, page 8 of fighting, before we get to 2013.
Back now to 2013. But
on page 8 of fighting, we do get some dialogue where Mystique and Nightcrawler discuss the fact that they look a lot alike.
We're both blue.
And there can only be one blue superhero in the Marvel Universe.
Unless they're related.
Only a mother would know.
Dun, dun, dun. I don't even know what happened after that.
Well, and we do find out they are related.
I believe.
Mom is. Know.
Yeah, Mystique is the mother of Nightcrawler.
Yeah. Is she really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and okay, so I just read this.
It was subsequently proven that Kurt's mother is Mystique.
Okay.
Yeah, so I just read this online in preparation for this episode, but and this is kind of weird, but in an unexpected twist, the writers originally, Claremont originally planned to have Destiny and Mystique be in a relationship, and Mystique was going to take the form of a man to so that both of them could be the parents of Nightcrawler, but the comic code prohibited the explicit portrayal of gay or bisexual characters, so they had to switch it up and make Mystique the mother and somebody else the father. And so, so originally Destiny was supposed to be the mother, Mystique was the father.
Interesting. And okay, well,
2013.
This is the page. This is the panel. The classic panel.
They're sneaking up on the most important Sentinel in the entire world. As he works privately in his office, and Wolverine's gonna sneak up on him.
This is very modern too. This is very modern. He has a stand-up station. So this is modern office stuff. I mean, this is very, very accurate for 2013.
There's a guy who's got one at work, and he presses a button, and it goes down in his regular desk. He presses the button again, goes up, stand-up station. I love it.
I wish I had that.
Man. But the Sentinel cannot be snuck upon.
No.
And he destroys Wolverine.
It's a tender moment because it's the last fastball special that Colossus and Wolverine in that timeline will ever have.
And how do we know that Wolverine's dead? Because as we get to the next page, we see a frame with just Wolverine's arm. And when I say his arm, I mean the metal.
Just the metal. Okay. It was done pretty easily here in 2013. You know, 1980, yep. Looking forward to 2008 or 2013. Wolverine, he died pretty easily. I'm curious. Maybe he's just not dead. I mean, maybe we assume he's dead because you said, like you said, you just see his skeleton. But I've only seen him die one other time where it actually stuck, and that was in X-Men Forever, which is a fantastic series, by the way.
Does he die at the end of Old Man Logan?
I don't remember.
I can't remember either.
But anyway, yeah, it just seems like it's a little too easy based on how many times he's and what he's gone through since then. But in 1980, I mean, how long has Wolverine been around? How long has it been since the reboot?
I don't know. I'll do a quick check.
It hasn't been that long.
So, as Matt's looking that up, we get three pages of fighting here in 2013. And these are pretty intense pages because we see Wolverine die, which we know he's dead because we see the arm. We see Storm die when she gets the stake, just like on the comic. And then we see a crying Colossus holding over the body of his lost friend, Storm. And then we also see kind of in the sideline, we see Rachel. And she's protecting the body of Kate. And she goes to mentally be with Peter. And so off screen, off camera, he dies.
And everybody dies.
So now Rachel and Kate are the only ones left in 2013.
The cover promised it to us.
Yep. So I've got the first appearance of Wolverine here, The Incredible Hulk, number 180, cover date October 1974.
Okay. Hey, that's when I was born. October 1974.
Whoa.
You and Wolverine.
We share commonalities.
You share cover dates.
But as far as the giant size X-Men, though, that's what I was wondering.
That was 1975.
Yeah, okay.
All I know is we've got three pages left, and I sure hope that this story doesn't resolve overly quick.
Well,
because it's 1980. Again, three pages left to go. 1980, Destiny stands there with some sort of gun, a crossbow. That's what it is, a crossbow. Looking at Senator Kelly, about to fire when the anomaly, Kitty Pride, jumps through her?
Yeah.
Jumps into her.
Jumps through her body and knocks the crossbow so the arrow misses.
In the moment it misses, she goes into the falling back into the future, switching mindy thingy. And then we get a page. So Senator Kelly, I guess, is no longer in danger.
From that threat.
In the next page, we get, hey, Kitty, do you feel okay? And let's pick her up off the floor and jump back in Warren Worthington's airplane.
And flying back home.
Well, what will happen? What will happen? Did we change the future? And then in the very, very last page, we actually get a page that has nothing to do with the story, as our good friend Sebastian Shaw meets with Senator Kelly.
Okay.
And they begin to work on Sentinels.
So Wolverine, you said, never looked happier in that panel, in that first issue. I don't think he's ever looked more comfortable and rested than in this panel here on the plane, where he's just got his hands behind his head. He's just reclining on that couch like there's no tomorrow.
Daniel, can I ask you a question? So I have here on my shelf this trade that I got in the early 90s. That panel with Sebastian Shaw isn't in this trade. The last panel I have is Angel saying, Professor, we saved Senator Kelly. Kitty's mind has been returned to her body. And then there's a few other talking points, but that's the last thing I see, and then it says the end. So what happens after that?
There's an entire page. It shows the White House. It's a month later, and apparently Senator Kelly has forgotten that mutant saved his life.
Okay.
And then they are bringing in to meet with him this industrialist, Sebastian Shaw, who is offering to work with them to create Sentinels through a project called Project Wide Awake. And they introduce another character, Henry Peter Greitch, who is just all fired up about mutants. And you know he's fired up because he's shaking his fist. So you know he's shaking his fist because they put the little movement around it. So you know he's mad.
He's angry.
I know the Gyrick. I know that Gyrick family. They're bad news.
And it previews the fact that the next issue, Demon, which you gotta like this. When you're alone, Kitty Pryde, no one can hear you scream.
Okay, so this page makes me not want to read on at all. But the fact is, the next issue is another classic X-Men issue, and it's really good.
It's the Brood.
Yeah, it's well, no, I don't think it is the Brood.
It's not the Brood? Okay, I'm seeing the cover.
It's the Demons, and they're from an earlier issue of X-Men. Maybe it is the Brood. I don't think it is, but maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, it's basically Kitty Pryde at home alone. It's Home Alone meets X-Men meets the first Alien movie.
No, it is the Demon.
So it's a classic. It's a Christmas issue, which if we do a holiday themed thing, this will be one of the issues we talk about when it comes to Christmas time.
That's a good idea.
It really does look Broodish, though.
Yeah, but I think it's meant to look more alien-ish than Broodish. But anyway, we're not talking about X-Men number 143, Merry Christmas, X-Men. Guess what just came down the chimney?
Evil.
But it is a good issue.
All right, so there's our synopsis, boys.
You said off microphone, I thought you said... I don't know. I'm going to breeze through it pretty fast. I was expecting you to be like...
you guys keep interrupting
Terminator me. Happened. You know, I was expecting that kind of thing.
But, I thought you did a great job, Daniel. Don't listen to him.
No, I'm just so saying emotional. What I was expecting.
He's mean to me.
So basically, this is the plot from Terminator.
Mm-hmm.
And my big question, knowing what I do know about the Terminator, is that Jim Cameron mentioned that he took his plot line from The Outer Limits, a couple episodes of The Outer Limits, and actually ended up losing a lawsuit to Harlan Ellison, and now Harlan Ellison is mentioned as some sort of story thing in the credits for Terminator. But those episodes of Outer Limits, this comic book, these two issues of the comic book remind me more of Terminator than those issues of... or those episodes of The Outer Limits. And so I almost wonder if Jim Cameron also was reading a little bit of X-Men or something. Because this came first.
It's not like Jim Cameron ever repurposed a good story.
It's true. It's true. And then Bryan Singer, director of X-Men Days of Future Past, consulted with Jim Cameron to help him with the time travel shenanigans.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It's just kind of, okay. So the guy who may have gotten his story from the comic that you're adapting right now.
All right, Ben, let me ask you the question.
Ask me the question.
Does this story deserve its place in comics history?
I don't think so. It's possible that part of it is because this is the first time you've seen some of this kind of stuff in comic books. But the storyline... It reads so densely. That's not a bad thing necessarily, but there's just, I'm trying to look at it, you know, in the eyes of someone from 1980 who's experiencing it for the first time. And instead of experiencing it as someone who read it, you know, 35 years later and read it knowing it was a classic, what do you think? Am I crazy?
You're crazy.
You know, Daniel, you said you would have given this a 5. I gave it a 4 out of 5. I think it's good. I mean, I see what you're saying, Ben. I think maybe the fact that it still held my interest, even though I was so separated from knowing what, because I don't know what the status quo of the team was at this point. So I'm excited to hear more about that from you. But yeah, I mean, even though I didn't really know what the status quo was, I was sucked into the story. They did a great job at catching me up and explaining things. I mean, I don't know that they needed to have the full explanation just from the past issue again, because I felt like there's a lot of repetition. The fight scene was way too long. So is it, I mean, there's been a lot of great stories. I guess if you're just looking at X-Men storylines, I'd say easily, maybe, you know, easily an all-time great in the X-Men mythology. But in all of Marvel Comics, I don't know if it's fair to name it number 25 on the list of Marvel's greatest comics of all time.
Yeah, and I'd be hard-pressed to say, okay, here's the 25 more that deserve to be placed above this one.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand why some of the classic status here. You get to see the future of the X-Men. But that said, it's not that interesting. The future of the X-Men is they live in a post-apocalyptic world, and Kitty Pryde and Colossus are married. And Franklin has a lady named Rachel.
Yep.
There it is. Wolverine's still around. He's got some gray hair.
But maybe it's just, is this the first time that the X-Men universe really started to dabble with time travel and alternate universes? Because if that's the case, then this is huge. Because now that's what the X-Men, in many ways, are known for.
Yeah, how many more times do they go to this world? How many more times do we see Sentinels from the future? You know, the whole Bishop piece.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is, you know, a keystone to tons of plots in the future.
Okay, but what you're saying is Star Wars Episode One, Phantom Menace, is an important story because it tells us all these key things. That's what you're saying. I mean, I'm not saying that, I'm not putting this on the same comparison level with Episode One, but I'm saying, okay, yeah, maybe it led to some great stuff, but there's a lot of other things that were leading to great stuff too, you know, or earlier than. And I just look at this and I just think, okay, the story itself has an interesting premise, but they don't take it as far as it could go. And I think part of that might be because, well, we don't want to, you know, we don't know what the future of the X-Men is going to be. So we don't want to say too much about their future. But then it ends. It just turns into a great big giant fist fight with all the X-Men. And then, like you said, Daniel, oh, we got 3 pages left. We got to wrap this up.
Every comic seems, I feel like even modern comics has that problem nowadays, and especially you get that feeling in these 6-issue arcs.
But you just said, you just used the word
setting it up, and then okay, go ahead.
You just used the word problem. It's problematic, and this should have been. I feel like there should have been more resolution tied into like actual future knowledge, maybe, instead of just okay, it's got to be Kitty Pryde who wins the day because she's the one who was sent back in time. But it, you know, there's nothing that like they could have been like, well, we look back and we know this is going to happen. We also know these are the people who are going to be involved. Kitty Pryde would know about Destiny and Mystique and Blob. And she would, it seems to me, she would have some knowledge of their strengths and weaknesses. Maybe
well, you know what you're looking for. You romantic. You're looking for that future, that future scene in the Xavier Mansion where you find out that Kate and Peter are still together.
I'm not.
Because they're teaching in class. That's what you're looking for.
No, although I did like some of that kind of thing. But no, I'm looking for, you know, more of a reason to send someone back in time than just, hey, something's going to happen, and then let's have a full issue of fighting and bad dialogue.
You know, something that this storyline does do that's important is in Marvel Comics, you can't really go back and alter the past to make a better future. Every time you try to do that, you're really just creating a divergent timeline. So one reason we know this is because Rachel can exist in Marvel's current 616 Earth, even though she is the daughter of an alternate future Cyclops and Jean Grey. So that's kind of, I mean, it just kind of starts to set the tone for you can't change anything. You just create a divergent, maybe better future.
Well, and that's what happened, though, is and that kind of brings up an interesting quandary then, where if all you're doing is creating another universe that might have a better outcome, is that a reason to go back in time if your own universe is still going to keep what it has? Because that you said you can't change time. I want to say it was something with Ben Grimm in Marvel 2-in-1. Where it's like in the 50th issue or the 100th issue or something like that, he tries to go back in time to stop the accident from ever happening. Mm-hmm. You know, and finds out that that's, you're just creating another timeline, and that kind of sets it the precedent. I think that happened before this issue.
Okay.
I want to find out though. I'm not sure exactly. So I'm gonna look for that. But
so Daniel, have you fully answered this question?
Do you think it deserves?
I think it's a good story. I mean, I'm judging it as a comic book against other comic books.
Yeah.
And so the things that I see as being problems are things that are either A, 1980-isms, or B, the physics of a comic book.
So I do think that's a really fair assessment.
Okay, April 1979, Marvel 2-in-1, issue 50. Now, Marvel 2-in-1 was Ben Grimm meeting up with another character from the Marvel Universe.
It was like the Thing team-up.
Yeah, so this one was Marvel 2-in-1. The Thing battles the Thing. And so you kind of see his old school look where it's more smooth versus his chunky classic look. And yeah, when he tells Reed about going back in time using Dr. Doom's time machine, and when he comes back, he tells Reed, and Reed explains to Ben that the past is immutable. And instead of changing his own history, he created an alternate reality. Which is this, so that makes this issue a very important issue in Marvel history, simply because that's something they do come back to.
Mm-hmm.
So is that what happened here then?
I think so.
So there,
because Rachel still exists. She doesn't stop existing, and the older Kate Pryde still exists in future storylines.
Because they do come back to that world, then, right?
Yeah, Excalibur traveled there. I mean, there were sequels to the storyline. So yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, anything else to add then? You think it deserves this?
I think we also need to call out that this is a classic golden period for Uncanny X-Men, because this is Chris Claremont and John Byrne working together.
That is true. That is true.
So I mean, this is one of those times where, because of that creative team, the Uncanny X-Men was probably one of the finest books that Marvel was putting out at the time.
Yeah,
that's true.
And the other thing is, okay, we were in issue 141, 142, not too long before this. You had issue 1, I'm going to go ahead and look, so I'm not just saying that. Okay, 138 is Cyclops leaving the team, so that's why Storm is the leader in this issue. Because right before that, in issue 137... that's the big, huge Dark Phoenix storyline. The big climax where Jean Grey is taken over by the evil Dark Phoenix and ultimately, you know, well, do we spoil that? We've already spoiled this. We're going to have to put a spoiler alert at the beginning of this.
Yeah, go ahead and spoil it.
She's, you know, she's this evil Phoenix that has destroyed worlds. And I think it's the... the Shi'ar yeah. Empire, they come, they want to destroy her because she killed the world. And they're like, well, she didn't do it, she can control it. And then they end up, she basically, she dies. You know, it's, and so because of that.
Whoa, Jean Grey dies? That would never happen.
Yeah. But that ties into the all-new X-Men, which is something I am reading monthly. And
that's currently.
Yeah, which is current. Well, they just had a trial of Jean Grey, where Guardians of the Galaxy got involved, and it's the Shi'ar Empire coming back and being like, okay, she's got the potential to be the Phoenix still, even though she comes from a timeline before it happened to her. Future Jean Grey... past Jean Grey, who died, did some terrible things, and this version of the past Jean Grey, who's younger, but has the potential to do it again. So,
just in case listeners don't know, the current all-new X-Men comic has the original X-Men from the past, from the 60s, they've transported through time, and they're now living in present day.
Yes.
And so now they're experiencing, and a lot of people have said this is a good jumping on point if you're not currently reading comics, because everything that you as a new reader may not know about the Marvel Universe currently, the same thing applies to these younger versions of the X-Men. They're learning about the Marvel Universe, you know, throughout all these different comics.
Yeah, they came, and it's a fun story for me because I like this set of X-Men. So
I think, yeah, I'm going to side with Daniel. Even though I give it a 4, I think it does deserve its place in Marvel history. I'm not positive it should be the 25th all-time greatest, but it definitely deserves a high place. I do kind of want to hear more about the status quo of the team. So you started talking about the Dark Phoenix. What about these other characters, the giant-sized X-Men and all that stuff?
Well, I mean, the giant-sized X-Men happened a long time before this. And basically, it was like the new round of students to become X-Men. And Cyclops was still around a little bit. And the other guys were, you know, in and out. Iceman and Angel joined another team for a while. And so basically, it's just introducing new mutants. And this is where you have Kitty Pryde coming in issue number 139. So she's not been in... I mean, she's the primary focal point of these two issues, plus the next one. The Christmas one. They bring her in 139, and she's, you know, 2 issues later saving the universe with, you know, the adult version of that character. But yeah, there's some good stuff going on here. I mean, this Dark Phoenix storyline, I would honestly, that definitely deserves a place in history. I would say this might be a top 100. I don't know. But... yeah, so this is kind of the what would you call it? One of the did you call it the Golden Age or a Golden Age?
A Golden Daniel? Age. Yeah. A Golden Age.
And if it had hit me at the right point in time, if I had been able to read this stuff when I was a kid, I think I would be a much, much, much bigger X-Men fan than I am. Because these are some pretty classic stories. So.
You know, I read this story probably when I was somewhere between 11 and 13, and it didn't really impact me. I read it once back then, and then again just now in preparation for this episode.
Yeah. So, it's a good story, worth talking about. But
let's kind of look at the other media. So I already mentioned the animated series. It's a completely different storyline that draws from other... it uses the name Days of Future Past, and it uses the assassination template, but it brings in other elements of time travel stories, including Bishop and things like that. So that's one thing. But, of course, we just had, here in 2014, the movie come out. So who wants to talk a little bit about the movie and how it compares?
I liked it.
I think that X-Men Days of Future Past, the movie, deserves its place in the top 25 superhero movies ever.
Agree. Totally agree.
I'm not putting it at number 25, but it's in those 25. I actually would put it in my top 5. I mean, there are certain movies that it can't knock out, but as far as X-Men movie goes, it's either the best or the second best. Trading places with First Class, depending on my mood.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I think the changes that you see made in this story, they make sense for the movie universe. You know, instead of Kitty Pryde coming back or Kate Pryde coming back, it's Wolverine. That makes sense. That's their big character. That's their headliner. They have to get him into the movie.
And it's fun because you get to see him in the future. You see him in the past, but it's fun. Hugh Jackman is just a fun guy to be with.
Exactly. And the other big focus you have to put in there is you have to put a big focus on Mystique because she's a huge star right now with Jennifer Lawrence. I mean, she can do no wrong. She can do an indie movie, and it's huge. And so they have to make sure to put plenty of room in that movie for her. And so one of the big differences is, you know, in 142, we see a lot of Mystique. But what we don't see in the movie is the brotherhood with her. We don't see a lot of extras. Well, in the movie, you kind of explain why there's not a lot of brotherhood with her. And in fact, what happened to the brotherhood is explained.
Yeah,
and again, I think it makes sense because do we really need Blob and Avalanche and Destiny? And it's just you're getting and there's only so much room on the screen.
And for her, as a shapeshifter, it makes sense for her to be a solo assassin. You know, it makes sense that she – I mean, Yeah, with Blob, I mean, literally, but she doesn't need to be carrying around a lot of extra weight. You know, she needs to be in, out, quick, fast, hidden, you know, protected and camouflaged. And so, no, I don't begrudge that movie any of the changes. Of course, I don't consider this a really great read to begin with. So,
yeah, I mean, I've kind of made my peace with superhero movies being different than the comics that they're inspired by. So there was a time, I think even after I saw First Class, I felt disappointed about how much things had changed in characters and storylines. But by the time I got to Days of Future Past, I was fine with them having their own universe, their own unique characters. And so I really liked the movie. I do think it's interesting, you know, when you compare the two, Days of Future Past, the movie, had a strong focus on the character of Professor X, whereas in the comic, he's barely in any of the panels.
Yeah, well, and Magneto, he's only in a couple panels in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so I'm, you know, the Mystique connection's great. The assassination thing is good. They use good elements of it, and of course, just seeing kind of the apocalyptic future with the Sentinels. I mean, I think it deserves the title Days of Future Past, and it's a good adaptation. Well, I guess maybe not adaptation. It's a good inspired by movie.
Yeah, it's a variation on a theme.
Yeah.
And they work well for what, I mean, Days of Future Past the comic was a product of 1980 X-Men, whereas the movie is a product of, you know, 2014 movie mythology, and they're using it to, like the Star Trek movies, to have their cake and eat it too. We want a reboot, but we want to keep Hugh Jackman. And, I really enjoyed it. I like the ending. I like the final scene, which we're not going to spoil, but I like the final scene and some of the, you know, familiar faces that are popping up throughout the movies in the future and in the past, and just kind of some of the nostalgia that's there. So I liked it. And I like that it set up a new status quo, but we don't know what it is yet. And there's all sorts of things that could happen to these characters between the past and the present. And so I'm looking forward to seeing an X-Men movie set in the 80s now. Mm-hmm. That seems to be where they're headed.
I was kind of hoping that the Apocalypse movie would be based on Age of Apocalypse, but it doesn't look like they're going that direction.
No, although they're going with that title.
Well, it's not, the title is not Age of Apocalypse, it's just Apocalypse.
Is it?
Yeah, they changed it because the Avengers came out with Age of Ultron.
Oh, and Transformers, Age of
Extinction. Whatever.
Age of Extinction, yeah. Oh, I didn't know they had changed it.
Yeah, just straight X-Men Apocalypse. That's it.
I like that title a lot better. A lot better.
Perfect. Well, I think that's the Days of Future Past talk. So nice job going back to the past with me, guys.
All right. Well, I think that maybe we should take a look at our event series that we're reading. So, Matt, what are you reading right now?
Yeah, well, like we were talking about last time, I've been going through Crisis on Infinite Earths, and so I discussed issue one in our last episode, and so I thought maybe I'd dive into issue two a little bit here.
Not issue four?
No, I think I'm just going to go straight to issue two.
Oh, we do have a time machine. We don't have to go with linear time here.
I mean, I thought for the listeners, we should just kind of stay chronological.
Okay,
so,
all right.
Yeah, so the issue has a lot of characters that I'm not familiar with. You know, again, I should probably... Hey, Ben, would you mind looking up cover date for this one?
Yeah, I'll do that right now. Cover date, right, so, May 1985. On sale date is February 85.
So I'm familiar with some of these characters. Like, the issue opens with Anthro, who's sort of a caveman, young kid character. I'm familiar with the fact that he exists, but I don't know very much about him, really. Really, when it started to take off for me was a few pages in. We've got Batman's first appearance in Crisis, which is interesting. I didn't even realize he... Well, I think I realized, but he didn't even make an appearance in the first issue because it was too full of other characters that were from the multiverse. So Batman's taking on Joker when out of nowhere, the Flash appears, and he's warning him that the world's about to end. So this seems scary, but then to make matters worse, the warning itself is kind of scattered. Flash is acting kind of weird. But then he disintegrates right before Batman's eyes. So it kind of gets all skeletal, and that gets weird. So then we have a little brief prologue, and We cut to Monitor explaining his plan to this, you know, it's like a force of 15 different heroes and villains from the multiverse that he's going to take against this villain and try to save the multiverse. There is kind of a good quote here from Lila, Monitor's sidekick. She says, "In 5 crucial eras throughout time, the Monitor has planted certain devices powerful enough to halt the antimatter tide. 5 eras which coincide with the existence of heroes such as you. For the presence of such heroic ideals creates its own focal point." Well, that's pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, so then we've got a scene on Oa where, you know, we have the Guardians of the Universe, who kind of are in charge of the Green Lantern Corps.
They're more important than the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, a little bit more important. And so there's a, kind of a nice scene with them, but then the mysterious villain, who we don't yet know who this is, attacks the Guardians of the Universe, and things do not look good. I think they might have been demolished, but I'm not sure yet, because I haven't read on quite yet. Meanwhile, Lila, as I mentioned, Monitor's sidekick, she went and picked up a baby. The baby that was saved from Earth 3 in the last issue. He's now existing in the Earth 1 plane. But guess what, guys? He's actually rapidly aging. Anything? Okay. Well, and right now, you know, even though he should be an infant, he looks to be about 5 years old at this point. So that's weird. I don't know where that's going. We also have one of Monitor's, forces to fight this evil is a bad guy named Psycho Pirate. But guess what? The villain, the mysterious villain, kidnapped Psycho Pirate. Yep. And now is forcing Psycho Pirate to work for him instead.
I just love that guy's name, Psycho Pirate. I don't know anything about him other than he's involved in what you're reading.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only frame of reference I have. Is I only hear, I just know that. Wait, but what a great name!
Have you read Crisis on Infinite Earth?
I have not.
Oh man, so I'm spoiling you here. Do you mind?
No, I don't mind. I do have a question for you when you're done with this issue.
Okay, yeah, definitely. So I'll quit. I've got one more line here, or a couple here. Psycho Pirate basically. At first, it seems like he doesn't necessarily know if he wants to work for this super evil force. So, somehow, this guy has the power to basically remove his face. So, picture The Matrix, where Agent Smith takes away Neo's mouth. It's that kind of thing, only his whole face. The whole face. So then, of course, he obliges. Psycho Pirate obliges and works for him. The Monitor, meanwhile, is learning all about this and reveals that Psycho Pirate was extremely important to his plan because his enemy is one of emotion.
Ah.
And that's basically where it all closes, and so now we're left just thinking everything's... Oh, no, there is a little scene in the future with Commandy, a future kid. So it's like we've got Anthro and Commandy who are not the same, but they seem sort of similar. Anyways, everything's a mess. This is a huge crisis. Not just on one Earth, but on...
on infinite multiple Earths.
Maybe even infinite Earth. So, yeah.
It's a mess.
It's not just a mess. It's a crisis, man.
I know. I'm glad they went with the crisis instead, because mess on infinite Earths would have been a much worse title.
Yeah. Doesn't sound as...
go ahead.
It just doesn't sound as impressive.
You know, I just dove right into this. I didn't give it much explanation. I guess we're counting on listeners having heard... you know, me talk about issue one, but did you guys have any questions that I can clear up for you?
I have one big question, but it's not something that needs to be cleared up. I really want to know, based on you reading these two issues so far, is this something that you recommend someone just pick up as an interesting read? Not as a comic book history homework.
Yeah.
But as a good read.
I completely understand your question, and I don't think I can say so yet.
Okay.
To be honest, I mean, like you were saying, I feel like it's homework in the sense that you have to read. It's a must read. It's a classic. I think maybe the most important event in comics history. So I have to read it. Mm-hmm. But not being very familiar with the pre-crisis DC universe, a lot of these characters and their importance is kind of just going over my head. I briefly mentioned Anthro and Commandy. I have no idea who they are. Even, you know, Monitor, the guy who's trying to save the day here, has a team of 15 different characters, and I probably have heard of half of them, if that. So, yeah, did I tell you guys the list before? I mean, I'm not going to read the whole thing now, but it's a list of, I would say almost, no-name people in the sense that they're not important in modern comics. So, as of now, I can't highly recommend it.
Okay.
But, I mean, you have to read it. It's Crisis.
Yeah, I just haven't gotten around to it. I never purchased it. I've never, you know, just... I don't know what I'm waiting for. Just haven't read it.
It's sort of intimidating to me, and so I'm glad that the show is making me read it. It's kind of forcing me to get into it, because the book is pretty huge. And as we were talking about with the X-Men book, it's really wordy, lots of explanation. In this case, it's a little bit better, because then I get a feel for who the characters are, but yeah, this takes time to go through. It's not a quick read by any means.
Okay. Daniel?
Yes, sir?
What do you got for us today?
Evolutionary War, Part 2, as found in Punisher, Annual Number 1. From 1988, on the shelves, April 19th, 1988, this is a comic that I bought in 1988 off the shelf, off the spinner rack, to be honest, probably at the mini mart. And $1.75 back then would have been huge. That would have been at least two comics. So the investment in this, thank goodness I'm reading it years, decades later.
Yeah, it's basically, you went back in your time machine. You're just paying cover price.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is broken up into three stories. The first story, Evolutionary Jihad, is written by Mike Maron, who wrote Punisher for nearly four years. And really, this story feels like a Punisher story, not really an Evolutionary War story. And I'm sorry, I've upset you. Punisher's in Bogota, and he's there to kill a drug dealer. And while he's getting ready to make that kill, there's an attack on a village, and it's the High Evolutionaries Eliminators who have come. They are to kill junkies and crazies, and the Punisher is on the crazy list because these are two things that are slowing evolution. The Punisher winds up cooperating with the drug dealer, El Cayman. Eventually, the two of them are kind of stuck in a trophy room together. They explode they beat up all the eliminators, and they explode a fish tank, and Punisher lets El Cayman die and saves his daughter, Lucinda. You notice who I never mentioned in this entire story? Yeah, that's right. High Evolutionary. Yeah, and this doesn't at all feel like it's tied to Part 1 at all. It's also not as trippy as Part 1. It's not as philosophical as Part 1. It is truly a Punisher story. And I've left a whole lot out of it because it's Punisher shooting.
So it's just you had fighty-fighty, talky-talky, and now shooty-shooty.
Yep, okay. Exactly. There's a lot of shooty-shooty. Part 2 is Three Hearts, written by Roger Salick, who I only found 11 credits for. Almost all of them are Punisher. And this is a Chip story. Chip is a sidekick to Punisher, the guy who armors him, makes all of his gear. And basically what's happening is Chip, he has a friend who passed away, and his wife Felicia is now remarried, and her new husband is a political assassin, and because she's uncovered his secret, he's going to kill her. And so Chip is trying to save her and negotiate. We do see a nice anti-aircraft gun go off. We get to hear how there's three hearts, the one we show the world, the one that we keep to ourselves, and the one that we don't even know. But in the end, Chip winds up negotiating with the assassin, gives him his car, and then blows his own car up.
Okay.
And then because we need to fill some pages, there's really a page, two pages that look like they're coming from the Marvel Handbook. One is the battle van. One is the Punisher's warehouse. And then finally, we get our few pages with the Mike Grunwald story, Pet Project, which is about Wyndham before he's the High Evolutionary, following up on the fact that he now has this DNA map, getting kicked out of school, realizing nobody understands him, and getting himself set up in a castle in the Balkans so he can work alone.
Yeah. I honestly wish I could do that same thing. I do. All right, so is it getting you excited about the next Evolutionary War issue? How's Punisher doing? How's it helping you out, man?
Uh-oh.
Oh, Daniel.
Bad timing. It doesn't sound like he was very excited about it.
No, I'm not excited about editing. So
nah. No, don't edit this. We're good.
Oh, he's coughing.
He's coughing.
He hit the cough button.
Oh, man. I was talking. Oh. You got to edit now. So
no,
what did
no,
I miss?
Oh, no. I don't think so. I think we're good.
This is good. So, Daniel, he asked you, did it make you excited about the next chapter in the Evolutionary War?
Next chapter, Silver Surfer Annual number 1, maybe the Evolutionary War will finally start.
I wonder.
Are you glad that you're reading through this?
Oh yeah. I loved this story as a kid. So, and now I've been able, thanks to the time machine, to collect the whole thing. So, and I haven't read it since 1988.
So Nexus Silver Surfer, I have that one. I wasn't able to read Punisher with you. But I'm getting the impression that really the only real connective tissue is that's kind of issue to issue is this the backup story.
Yeah,
it's kind of the High Evolutionary's origin story.
Yep.
Okay. That's interesting. But I do remember reading one of the Spider-Man ones, and it's just there's these weird guys that show up and it's just like they interrupt the story and then they're gone.
Well, and we do, in that backup story, get a first cool moment, which is probably the High Evolutionary's first evolutionary creature, evolved creature, where he takes his dog Dempsey and turns him into a hominid. And, of course, Dempsey's so afraid that he runs off, and then Dempsey gets killed, and that's one of the reasons why you have to go hide in the Balkans so that stupid humans won't kill, you know, his creations.
Yeah. Because they're some pretty weird creations. I just remember the one cow lady that kind of...
Oh, she's coming.
Yeah. She was in one of those that I... Because that summer, I was buying annuals off the spinner rack.
Didn't she raise... Is this a spoiler? She raised some very important mutants.
We'll get to it.
All right. I'm going to let Ben talk so I can cough up a lump.
Well, I'm going to talk about Secret Wars Month 2. Now, Secret Wars Issue 2 came out in 1985, and it was, I'm looking here, I'm not seeing it, there it is, August of 1985. And then the tie-in issues came out the next month in September of 85. But yeah, so Issue 2, you got the Beyonder. This guy, man, he just wants to know what it means to be human. And there's a lot of words in the first couple of pages of him just describing him, his thoughts. And so he takes on Steve Rogers' body. He wears a white jumpsuit, bodysuit. And there's all sorts of hijinks and shenanigans. For example, he sees a guy ordering a drink and a bottle of pop and a hot dog at a hot dog stand. And so he goes and asks for the same thing. And because he's feeling this feeling in his stomach, he doesn't know what it is. Hunger? What? And so he just eats the bottle. Because that's funny. And then it just gets weird because all of a sudden we're in the middle of a Fantastic Four issue. It's not even like, okay, here's the Fantastic Four dealing with the Beyonder. It's here's all of the subplot stuff that's from the Fantastic Four. It's Hatemonger is doing all this weird stuff and... He transforms Sue Storm into this weird creature. She's no longer Sue Storm, no longer Invisible Girl. She's Malice, Mistress of Hate. And so she has this costume that, you know, we were talking about Storm, her costume. It's very reminiscent of Storm's costume, only with more spikes. And that golden suspender ring is between her bosoms.
I'm pretty sure that the Richards... couple kept that outfit after that.
I don't know, but and so then you're back to Beyonder, but it's just weird because he's walking through town and everyone's like hating each other, And so it really is sticking with the continuity of Fantastic Four for that month. He starts following Peter Parker around, and Peter is getting creeped out that this guy wearing this white jump or sweat white tights, basically, with no shoes and no gloves, and it's just white bodysuit. Beyonder follows him into his apartment, and he punches Beyonder, and Beyonder's like, "Everyone does that when they meet me. Why do they do this?" And he's, "Oh, I don't know." And then, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm from Beyond." And then Peter Parker realizes this is the Beyonder. And he's, "Oh, I've been such a bad host." And he's, "You can sleep on my, you can hang out here in my crib, you know?" And so he offers him some food. He's like, "Well, actually, I have this feeling in my lower abdomen." So this is where Peter Parker has to explain going to the bathroom. That's right. No. We spend almost a full page of Peter Parker. It's a full page divided between two pages, but of Peter Parker saying, "You've got to go to the bathroom. You can use mine. Here you go.
You can actually see the toilet."
Beyonder goes inside, and here's Peter Parker. He's standing outside the door. "Just call me if there's a problem." I mean, that's...
Oh, my God.
I say that to my three-year-old. You know, if there's a problem, Beyonder is in your bathroom, jerk. Of course there's a problem. But what am I going to do? I hardly believe this is happening. And then the Beyonder comes out and says, "The experience is consummated."
Oh, no.
And then the Beyonder leaves, and Spider-Man goes off to go do his thing, his Spider-Man thing around the city, and the Beyonder is... but then you're back to Fantastic Four, and I'm trying to figure out, is this just showing me the stuff? Is this just showing me the stuff from Fantastic Four number 281, or is this, I don't know. And so Beyonder talks to Reed while everyone else is fighting, and Reed's like, "Oh, wait up! I'll talk to the Beyonder here." And Sue Storm, she's really put out about that. She's not the hate monger or hate mistress anymore, but. Beyonder gets a suit, talks to a bag lady, and gets beat up. Everyone punches me. He goes to Luke Cage. He goes to Heroes for Hire because the bag lady gives him their card, and they're not there. So he pulls them through time, talks to them a bit, finds out from Luke Cage that money makes the world go round, basically, and then he sends them back to their place in time. So again, it's just like they're working so hard to be within continuity, but and so then he turns their building into gold. But yeah, here's the thing. At the end, you talk about wrapping it up real quickly. The last panel is a picture of Beyonder disappearing, Spider-Man and Luke Cage and Iron Fist standing there. And then in the it's just very meta. In the caption, it says, "Almost as an afterthought, the one from Beyond returns Luke Cage and Daniel Rand to the exact point in the past from which he borrowed them, leaving one slightly stupefied Spider-Man standing in front of a veritable mountain of gold, feeling very, very much alone." So he's turned their office building into purest gold. And so now we have three tie-in issues. One is Fantastic Four, number 282, which is all... Okay, so it's tied into... This is a Secret Wars 2 tie-in. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8... Nine pages of Franklin Richards having a dream about the Power Pack. Starting with page 10, we have Reed Richards wanting to go find the Beyonder and Sue Storm, or Sue Richards, arguing with him about it. She's like, "This terrible stuff happened to me. We need to go and get revenge on the people who turned me into that thing. And let the Alpha Flight, let the Avengers, let Spider-Man take care of the Beyonder." So they're fighting... Page 12, fighting on page 13, fighting on page 14. On page 15, Reed Richards says, "Okay, I'm not going to go after the Beyonder. We'll go into the Microverse, basically, to go after the villain who attacked you." So they go into the Microverse. Here's our tie-in. On page 20, well, page 19. On page 19, our tie-in to Secret Wars is Reed Richards saying, "The Beyonder is a problem. He's a menace. But... I'm here for Sue. I wonder what he's up to now." Turn the page. You get one panel of the Beyonder talking to what seems to be some sort of two-bit hood saying, "Listen, Beyonder, baby, there's two kinds of people in this world, winners and losers. Stick with me and you'll be one of the winners." And then we're back to their story. That's it. It ends with Psycho Man capturing them. And so, like, that just... It's John Byrne. He did script and pencils on this. And basically, it's John Byrne saying, oh, man, I got to tie this in.
He's saying, oh, man, what is Jim Shooter doing?
So this has to tie in. Oh, well, I'll have a panel where they say, I wonder where he is right now. And then we'll do a flashover. So then the other two are Web of Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man. Web of Spider-Man number 6, Amazing Spider-Man number 268. And I never noticed this before, but the two covers go together. It's a single image of, on one side, Spider-Man in his regular uniform. On the other side, Spider-Man in his new black outfit, which hasn't been revealed to be Venom. And then you have the building that was turned into gold in between the two. And I never noticed that these two images actually go together. But basically, you have Spider-Man dealing with the aftermath of the big building getting turned into gold. And
so who has the rights to it?
Well, that's just it. The United States government wants to get rid of it because there's so much gold there that it would totally throw the world economy into upheaval. And so Kingpin actually strikes a deal with the government to help them get rid of it. And but since he's helping them get rid of it, he's also knowing where it's going. And Spider-Man is watching Kingpin get this contract to help the government. And what does Spider-Man get? Nothing. Bupkis. And so our big climax at the end of Web of Spider-Man number 6. It's so bad because he's helping people get out of the building, helping rescue people. And then he sees a government agent dealing with Wilson Fisk, you know, the Kingpin. And so Spider-Man's like, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to take this notebook out of a trash can that got turned into gold. And so in the last page, the big climax is he's, hey, Anderson, look what I got here. I'm taking this and there ain't nothing you can do about it. Because see you in the funny papers, Anderson. And so he's taken this piece of gold that doesn't belong to him, and he's going to use it, you know. So then the next one, the Amazing Spider-Man, which is the second part of this thing, is basically Spider-Man thwarting the Kingpin's attempt to steal the gold, and he ends up, you know, that's the end. Is he helps them and he has a nice understanding with Anderson. So, yeah, as far as tie-ins go, it makes sense because it's, hey, we're going to reference the things that happened in Secret Wars issue 2 and talk about the aftermath. But it's also somewhat inane. I'm not real impressed. But what I'm getting out of this is the status quo of these titles at the time. The Fantastic Four lineup in this issue is Reed and Sue and Johnny and She-Hulk. And she's a fairly new addition to the team because Thing hasn't been around for a while, and which we'll find out more about him later on. But
well, he left at Secret Wars, didn't he?
Yeah, in Secret Wars. So the month Secret Wars comes out, number one, all the titles that were involved in the first Secret Wars, they have their characters disappear. The next month, in all the regular titles, all the characters come back, but Spider-Man's got a new costume. Thing is not with the Fantastic Four. And so you have to wait through those 12 issues of Secret Wars to find out all the things that happened to them. But you're not getting interrupted with these extra stories and stuff like that. With this, it's basically Secret Wars interrupting your Secret Wars 2 is interrupting your regular series. And so Ben Grimm actually stayed on the Secret Wars planet. The Battle World is what they called it. And it's a really cool set. I've read those, and it's about, I don't know how many issues it is, but it's really fun stuff of Ben Grimm fighting, you know, on this world, you know, this alien planet. So that's cool. And all this stuff with Franklin Richards, where he's dreaming about the Power Pack, and he's going to become a major character in the Power Pack series later on. And they actually reference that. They say, keep an eye out. You're gonna love what we do with them. And then with Spider-Man, it's interesting because the status quo for him is he's running around in both costumes. And there's a point where he says, oh, man, I wish I would have worn my black costume today so people would recognize me. You know, and it's just it's interesting. And that's what I'm loving about this reading through the Secret Wars, too, is seeing that kind of this is what's happening at this period in time in the Marvel Universe without me having to track down, you know, full runs of the comics. And so I'm just kind of getting this quick little glimpse into what were these guys up to back in 1985. So I'm enjoying it. I do not recommend reading it, though. I'm just going to say right now, it's not a good read. Even Reed Richards was not a good read in this. But, yeah, not fun. Not recommended.
So weird. But so
I'm enjoying myself, and if you like what I like, and if you like being able to see the things I'm seeing here, maybe. But I have a feeling it's going to get worse because I've read these a long time ago and I don't remember it getting really better. So
it's kind of funny because the three of us aren't necessarily recommending what we're reading, but we're all enjoying what we're reading.
Yeah. My next event, I want to pick something that's just really fantastic. That's my plan. So,
you know, before we leave tonight, let's, quickly plug what we're doing on the solo episodes. Do you want to start with Daniel?
Well, I'm going through Manhunter. In my next solo episode, I'll be doing Manhunter number one.
Yeah, and in my next solo episode, I'll be doing Star Wars number one and John Carter number two. And I'm trying to remember. Logan's Run number seven and 2001 number eight, I believe. But it's basically that month that Star Wars number one came out, what was the other sci-fi comics that were coming out from Marvel? And so, yeah, Star Wars begins, Logan's Run ends, there's a new character in 2001. Oh my goodness, guys, this Kirby 2001 stuff is just, it's cracking me up. I'm loving it and I'm hating it at the same time. It's so weird. Yeah. So, and then, John Carter number two, which John Carter has surprised me how much I'm enjoying that. So
nice.
And what about you?
Yeah. My twist on the solo episodes is that I am preparing myself for, this big Spider-Man event coming up later this fall. So it's going to be called Spider-Verse. It deals with all the different Spider-Man in the Marvel multiverse. And so I'm reading some different, based on what I've read from the solicits and previews for that storyline, I'm reading Spider-Man comics that will help prepare me to fully understand that story. So what I just, on the last, my last solo episode, I talked about, let's see, I think it was Amazing Spider-Man 30 through 36, but it's volume two. So these are from the early 2000s, and it introduced some characters that are going to be important now in this new upcoming storyline. So I don't want to give away who it is, but characters that first appeared in 2001, now in 2014, they're going to be important in these upcoming storylines. And I'm not positive which one I'm going to be doing next, but I think I'm kind of leaning towards doing Spider-Man Noir, because the big deal with Spider-Verse is that every Spider-Man that's ever existed, some that we've heard of, some that we haven't, they're all going to be in the storyline. So Spider-Man Noir, I think it takes place in the 30s, and there's some trades out for that. I'm probably going to do that next, but I'm not positive. So yeah, if you want to prepare yourself for a Spider-Verse, you can read along with me some of these early, well, not necessarily super early, but some of the Spider titles that will set the stage for that storyline.
Yeah, how deep are you planning to go?
I mean, I'm not certain. I had a lot of fun doing the last one, and so do you have something in mind?
Well, are you going to read the manga stuff?
I mean, every Spider-Man ever is going to be in the storyline, yeah. So that would include a manga Spider-Man.
Marvel manga, or whatever it was called.
Yeah, I'll be 100% honest here. I've never actually read one manga of anything. So if I did read a Spider-Man manga, it'd be my first ever.
Oh, that shouldn't be your first, but oh well. I've got them. I could send them your way, possibly, if you're interested in them.
Let me think about it, and I'll get back to you.
Because they're like even getting to like the 1601 Spider-Man.
Yeah, I don't have a list in front of me, but I think they're going to have Ben Reilly's Scarlet Spider, who's like my all-time favorite. They're going to have the Kane Scarlet Spider. They're going to have the Ultimate Spider-Man, Miles Morales. They're going to have the Peter Porker, the pig, the
Spider-Ham, yeah.
Spider-Ham, that's right, yeah. Spider-Man Noir, like I said. They're going to have the daughter of Spider-Man from an alternate universe who just went by Spider-Girl.
Yeah.
But then there's some that we've never heard of. So in one issue, they've already teased that in one multi or one parallel universe, Gwen Stacy actually gained the powers of Spider-Man. So instead, she's Spider-Woman, but it's Gwen Stacy under the mask. Superior cool. Spider-Man. I won't reveal too much about that now, but the character that was Superior Spider-Man is going to be in the storyline. So lots of stuff happening.
And when does the actual Spider-Verse stuff start?
I believe I'm pretty sure that some of the prelude to it starts in October 2014, and then the actual event starts in November 2014. So yeah, I think they're going to the prelude is under the heading Edge of Spider-Verse, and there's going to be 5 one-shots that will introduce different characters but set the stage for what's happening.
Okay. Excellent. That sounds fun.
Yeah, it is fun. Because it sort of has a purpose I'm excited to read the Spider-Verse, but I know that there's a lot that I don't know about Spider-Man history, so I feel like it's fun to read and then fun to talk about, and it helps me kind of solidify some of the facts that I'll need when going into that storyline.
Yeah. All right, cool.
Yeah.
Well, anything else you guys want to add?
Daniel, where can they find you?
You can find me at BetweenDisney.com and WelcomeToLevel7.com.
And you can find me at TheSciFiChristian.com.
And you can also find me at WelcomeToLevel7.com and StrangersAndAliens.com, but BenAvery.com also. That's good. It's usable. It's doable. So all that said then, everyone, I think, I don't know, should we leave the last word again to you, Daniel?
Good luck, kids. Make good choices.